Moncrief on News Talk.
When it comes to attempting to mitigate climate change, who are the biggest sinners? Oil companies? Climate change denying politicians? Nope. Men are to blame, at least according to a survey in France that found that men are responsible for 26% more emissions due to their tendency to drive cars and eat red meat. Not at the same time, we assume. John Gibbons is founder of the climatechange.ie website. John, good afternoon.
Hi, Sean.
Is this a French thing or a more general thing, do you suspect?
I think it's a more general thing. I think it's been observed around the world in different studies over the last decade and more. Men disproportionately consume. This is really what it comes down to. Now, there are a few little tweaks we should say in this. First of all, you have to correct a study like this for income.
Yeah.
And essentially, and men generally have more income than women. Therefore, they're creating more emissions because what we find right around the world is that income and emissions travel together. They're closely locked.
Yeah.
So therefore, you would expect, therefore, more emissions to come from men simply based on that. There's also an issue, of course, in relation to diet, that men physiologically eat more than women. So again, they had to correct for that, which is perfectly reasonable. But then when you get down into the weeds, there's still a statistically significant difference between the carbon or environmental impacts of men's, I suppose, consumption behaviour versus women. And that is notable, and it's been replicated, as I said, in studies that I've seen over the last decade and beyond.
Yeah, is that politics?
Partly, and of course it's something we're all familiar with recently, is this so-called anti-woke backlash, where the idea, for example, of being a soy boy, to use that dreadful phrase, has been sort of thrown in men's faces that, you know, to be a real man, you need to eat red meat, you need to drive a big-ass car, all this kind of stuff to assert your masculinity, a certain narrow view of masculinity. And we've seen very strong backlash. We've seen it in America, we've seen it in right-wing politics right around the world, this male backlash. And I think men defining themselves around consumption. Now, by the way, there's blame to go around here, right? For example, we know that in relation to fast fashion, which is a huge environmental impact, that is predominantly women, probably more than two-thirds. That's not a surprise. Mm. But when you shake it all down and when you break it all down, what you find in general is that men, and particularly well-off men, are the top of the pile in terms of consumption. But I would also stress, Sean, that this is a, you know, to do the numbers very briefly, if you take the top 1% of people in the world by income, which that's about 77 million people. So the world's richest 77 million, they produce more emissions related to their consumption than 5 billion of the world's poorest people.
Yeah.
So you often hear it said, oh, the problem with climate change and global warming, it's all there's too many people. No. There's a small, relatively small number of people in the world grossly over-consuming. And I suppose the big targets that are identified in this particular study is meat consumption. Well, meat consumption, but specifically red meat consumption, because that's the big heavy-hitting ticket item in relation to emissions because of the methane factor. Also cars, internal combustion cars, in other words, petrols and diesels, and also aviation flying. And we know this as well, Sean, that, again, a small single-digit percentage of flyers do most of the flying in the world. And we also know that more than 80% of the people in the world today have never set foot in an aircraft and never will.
Yes.
Yet aviation is the world's fastest growing sector for emissions. So what it really boils down to is, yes, men are the tip of the spear in relation to this. But what it's about is basically people in high income parts of the world, and I include, of course, Ireland in that, we overconsume our fair share of the global budget, if you like, for emissions. Now, unfortunately, what I've described as a global budget it's not a real thing. You know, you and I haven't been assigned a carbon budget, right? Which, by the way, we'll come back and talk some other time. We should be. Every human being, let's assume just for a crazy moment that we believed in equality and that we believed every person on Earth was as good or as bad as anybody else. Then we should we take the total amount of carbon that the world can bear and divide it by 8 billion, right? If that were to happen, for example, in Ireland, our typical share would be about 1 to 1.5 tonnes per person. At the moment, everyone in Ireland, on average, is accounting for about 12 tons. So you can imagine the kind of changes we're talking about here. They would be radical and far reaching. But unfortunately, Sean,
automatically then someone will set up some sort of trading thing so the people who will never set foot in a plane anyway can sell theirs over.
Oh no, absolutely. Look, every attempt at carbon trading have immediately been gamed by the markets. Mm. So it's a hiding to nothing. I merely put it out there because, you see, the global atmosphere doesn't really give a damn about what we think. All it knows is you get to a certain amount of carbon released into the atmosphere and really bad stuff happens. You push another 100 billion tons, even worse stuff happens. And as you move up to a half a trillion tons, basically the system fails. Mm. So we're kind of nudging in that direction very quickly. And that is being driven primarily by overconsumption, by folks like you and me in this part of the world who are driving it, the crisis. And the great irony, Sean, of course, is that the people on the sharp end of this stick are the people in the what we call the global south. In other words, the people closer to the equator who are producing most of the world's food, by the way, they're producing most of the world's resources, but they're getting the brunt. And by the way, the small share of the income, but they're getting the brunt of the climate impacts. But as we've noticed, we know, for example, that Europe is now the fastest heating continent in the world. Right? So these things, that's the thing about it. It's, you know, it's like a leaky boat. You know, the poor folks in the global south might be down the wet end of the boat right now. But if there's a big enough hole in the boat, being up the dry end of the boat shouldn't make you feel too comfortable. So at the moment, we're in the dry end of the boat. We're looking at the folks in the wet end of the boat and saying, oh, honestly, to God, these people, really, you know. But luckily, it has nothing to do with me. But of course, we're all in the one boat, so to speak, and the boat is going down. So
yeah, because you think that this very super wealthy cohort would have started to have noticed by now that maybe the holiday home in the Maldives might flood and that kind of thing. That even now they might start to notice it's having an effect on
you. Would think that, and again, extremely wealthy people, you know, tend to be very well resourced. So they tend to hedge their bets. So we know, for example, that lots of these people are creating doomer getaway bunkers. And I'm really, you know this, Sean, you've written about this in places like the South Island in New Zealand and other getaways for the hyper rich in the event of things going to a very bad place for the rest of us. So, yeah, they are aware of it. But what they're not prepared to do voluntarily is to give up one iota of their privilege. And I think it's important to stress that, you know, in the main, the folks that are really accelerating this process are the billionaire class. I mean, you know, if we had a rule, if I had a magic wand and I could do one thing to alleviate the climate crisis in the world tomorrow, my magic wand would make billionaires as a class disappear, never to return. We would have a better world. We'd have less inequality. We'd have less violence. We'd have less horrific politics if we could do that. But sadly, that's beyond my purview.
Yeah, okay. Well, you never know. It's really hard. At the same time, notwithstanding the total validity of everything you've said, when we have surveys like this and it's blaming kind of ordinary people, and I'm using the term ordinary in a very lateral sense, the predominant amount of damage being done to the climate isn't that being done by oil companies, by governments who aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, has been theorised that oil companies particularly have pushed this kind of narrative to make individuals feel guilty for it. So it's not Shell's fault.
That's a very good point. BP, the British Petroleum, or as they rebranded themselves 20 years ago, Beyond Petroleum, which, of course, was beyond a joke. but BP actually invented the world's first carbon calculator in the early 2000s, because you're absolutely correct. They came up with this genius idea that would get people fretting about their carbon footprint while BP itself continued to produce billions of tons of CO2, because it is very important to distract from the fact that a relatively small number of incredibly profitable, and it is important to say that the most profitable industry in human history is the global energy industry. Now, they have trillions of dollars in what are called sunk assets. These are untapped resources, be they mostly oil, gas and coal. Now, if and when the day comes when they accept the science and they say, right, we're going to have to write off those assets because they can never be burned, then what happens is you get a collapse in asset value and those big companies become much smaller. So understanding all of this, Sean, they're fighting tooth and nail to make sure that that day of reckoning doesn't happen anytime soon. So that's why you've seen, for example, in the 2024 US election, hundreds of millions of dollars from fossil fuel companies flooded into the elections. Of course, we saw the similar investment from technology companies. They're buying the best politicians, sorry, the most, no, I wouldn't say the best, the most politicians that money can buy.
Yeah.
And this has been what we've seen, it's the they call it the polluter's paradox, where the dirtiest industries in the world spend the most buying politicians because they have to protect their social license. So we've seen this with the fossil fuel industry. We're increasingly now seeing it with the global livestock. The industrial livestock industry are doing exactly the same thing. They're buying up politicians. They're pushing out phony research and flooding the airwaves to give the idea that business as usual is fine and anybody who says otherwise is an extremist or an outlier. But the reality is that these corporations are taking us down. And the issue really is, while we can certainly focus on what we do ourselves, and I kind of think of it as an 80-20 thing, Sean, about 20% of the responsibility for this really lies in the behaviour that you and I decide to take.
Yeah.
And there's no question, you don't get a free pass in this. We have to be responsible for our own behaviour, especially those of us in the privileged part of the world, as we are. But 80% is structural. It is the fact, you know, when you go to buy a car, what are they pushing you? When you go into the showroom, are they pushing you into a diesel car?
Yeah.
Are they not providing the infrastructure to support electrics? Or indeed, should you take the option for public transport? Are our politicians investing heavily in public transport? Are they subsidizing it? You know, I believe, for example, everybody should be getting free solar panels. It's to my mind, these are the kind of steps that we could be taking to really accelerate this. And some of them, by the way, like the free solar panels, would be super popular, right? Not all measures. And it is the thing for folks like me. You end up being the guy who says no all the time. Oh, we can't be doing this. We can't be flying. We can't do da-da-da-da-da. And people tend to tune out of that. I get that. But there's lots of positive steps that we can take to make the present fairer and the future a lot less hellish. And that, to me, is a fair deal, right? I've got kids. Many people listen to us have a strong investment like that in the future. And, you know, we need to consider, am I prepared to trade a little of my present comfort for future safety and security? I personally am. And by the way, I think anyone who, for example, insures their house, they're already doing that. They're taking money out of their pocket today to mitigate a risk tomorrow. So we're all familiar with this, but what we're not great at doing it is understanding collective risk. And that, I think, our politicians, I'm sorry, I do have to blame them. They haven't been great at explaining that we face a sort of a collective risk here that is simply unmanageable. And we're seeing this already, Sean, and I'm sure you're aware of it. The global insurance and reinsurance industry is creaking. They're ratcheting up billions in losses year after year. So we're moving to a point quite quickly. And I know in Ireland, it's reckoned about 100,000 houses out of our stock are approaching or are already considered to be commercially uninsurable. That means what happens? We can't just abandon those houses. What you have to do is the state becomes the insurer of last resort. But there's a limit to how many times the state can bail us out on these things. So basically, we've got a fire. We have to focus on getting the fire down because we can't deal with the consequences of the damage that fire is doing. So what we have to do instead is we've got to get back to source and turn down the flames because we can't manage it.
Yeah, John, thanks a million for coming in to us. John Gibbons there from climatechange.ie.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.